Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. If you're like me, medicine and all things health-related generally get put on the back burner. You know, we just don't pay attention until we need to. Well, this week here at RCP, we're paying attention to medicine and healthcare policy. All the things we normally take for granted. We got blood donation, malpractice, diabetes, and more here on Real College Podcast. It's important to donate blood. We all know this. We're told this again and again. But donating blood is a privilege, not a right. After the Pulse nightclub shooting in the summer of 2016, gay men and other men who have sex with men wanted to step up. We wanted to help donate blood to members of our community. But we couldn't. In the U.S., men who have sex with men can't donate blood unless they haven't had sex for a year. Reporter Maury Swanson has more.
Everyone's heard that they should donate blood. I personally had it drilled into me from childhood because my mom's a regular donor and she'd always come home and tell us why it was so important. It's important because it helps people with conditions such as anemia or certain cancers, people undergoing surgery, or people who need blood transfusions. But it can also be used in medical research and education, and it can be used to help develop finer, better medical technology. And considering it's such an easy act to donate blood, lots of people, like my mom, donate often and take pride in it. However, there's a section of the population who are not allowed to donate blood. Men who sleep with men in America currently have a one-year ban from donation once they've had sex. To get a history of this policy, I got in contact with Jacob Thomas from Out From Minnesota, who told me more.
Hello, my name is Jacob Thomas. I help run communications for Out Front Minnesota, Minnesota's largest LGBTQ advocacy organization.
Nice. So the issue of men who sleep with men not being able to donate blood is one that I've found very interesting for a long time. Like when I was like 16 and like they brought a van to school, they gave you a list of all the rules of like things you couldn't have done to donate blood. And I remember seeing like if you're a man who's had sex with another man within like the past year or whatever the limit was at that point, you're not allowed to donate blood. And I was like, oh. What? Like, and I was like getting really angry about it. Yeah, and like I wasn't. My friends were like, "Why do you care so much?" And I was like,
"No reason.
No reason at all. I just feel for them."
Yeah.
But what's been your experience with it?
So it's interesting. I have given blood in the past. So I actually used to be in the military, and like it's very prominent in the military to give blood, right? Because we understand that a lot of people, you know, sometimes we will need blood in certain situations. And it was something, you know, for a while when I was living as a heterosexual male, it didn't matter, right? I could still give blood. I wasn't having sex with men. But it was something always in the back of my mind that I was like, oh, if I ever did that, I would be disqualified from giving blood. And in the U.S., we actually used to have what was considered a lifetime ban. So if you'd ever had sex with a man at all in your life, and you were also a man, you were not allowed to give blood for the rest of your life. Which is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, pretty dramatic.
it's just like petty. We'll do some backstory, some history here. So blood banks here in the U.S. are ran by, or kind of the policies are administered through the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, mm-hmm. kind of sets the bar and the policies for what's allowed and what kind of procedures, things like that, should be involved in our blood bank process, how we handle blood, how we store blood, all those kinds of fun things. Mm-hmm. And so, if you recall, the whole world kind of dealt with an epidemic and is still very much dealing with an epidemic around HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. In the late 70s and 80s, U.S. press and U.S. officials kind of deemed it a gay disease. Mm-hmm. Before it was called HIV and AIDS, it was called gay cancer. Wow. So this is you know, part of our legacy as LGBTQ people, in having not only politicians, you know, Reagan at the time was president through most of that epidemic, and then his vice president, George H.W. Bush, then became president, and continued a legacy of inaction and disregard for people living and dying with HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. And no one really cared at all about the homosexuals dying from a policy standpoint or from a political standpoint until about 1985, when the FDA and the public realized that blood that was HIV positive was getting into our blood supply as, like, through our blood banks and through everything else. And the only reason then people cared was because straight people started also contracting HIV because of blood transfusions.
Mm-hmm. Which is a very, like, serious
That sucks. Yeah, it really sucks. Like, but it is very interesting from a historical standpoint to see that, like, that's the only time that action actually started happening was at that point. Uh-huh. And that was largely due to the FDA was, like, didn't care at all about their blood process. They were letting plenty of bad blood into our blood supply. And then at one point, it finally gets found out that HIV
is contracted by
it's contracted by blood, and we don't have any processes to actually take care of our blood and ensure that, like, people are getting blood that doesn't have infections in it of multiple types. And so then at that point they're like, oh shoot, we got to do something about this. And so their knee-jerk reaction was just, no, like, we're banning everybody. You can't give blood if you've ever had sex with men, because clearly the gays are the ones causing all this to happen. And that was just kind of the policy. And people were fighting against it and have been fighting against it since that was implemented, along with fighting the FDA and a bunch of other things, because they weren't giving people living and dying with HIV and AIDS the proper medication. They weren't actually, like, certifying drugs, a whole host of things. So then fast forward through decades of activism, and we finally get to a point where the FDA, and like I said, I'm pretty sure 2015, was like, okay, fine, I guess maybe a lifetime ban was a little rash. Why don't we just do a year deferral period? And so what that means is, if you are like me and are a man who has sex with men, I have to be abstinent for one whole year before I'm allowed to give blood.
But it's anyone. It's any kind of sex, though. So even if you're in, like, a monogamous relationship.
Yeah, any kind of sex. You've been married to your partner since you were high school sweethearts, you know, like, which is still extremely discriminatory. It still stigmatizes LGBTQ people and people who have, like, men who have sex with men. And it's also still completely unnecessary. Like, our blood goes through tests. Like, we test it for everything.
Because there's other, like, things in HIV that can be, like, in blood. Yeah, exactly.
And so we test it for a whole host of things. It just goes to further, like, put a claim out there that gay men specifically, and other men who have sex with men, are somehow dirtier. And it just further stigmatizes LGBTQ people in general.
Well, I remember I was reading, when I was researching for this, because I'm a good
reporter.
I was on, like, the website for the Red Cross, I think it is. That's, like, the American main blood place, and, like, because that's a common thing people say, they're like, don't they test the blood anyway? And I wanted to get the facts, and it was literally, like, one in a million, they said, like, because they do test all their blood, and they're like, the chance of, like, the possibility of HIV getting through those tests is, like, one in a million already, let alone, like, the chance of the person originally having HIV. And so it's like, when you, like, just look at those facts, it does just feel like it's very unnecessary. it all contributes, in my opinion, to the idea that, like, men sleeping with men is dangerous and dirty and not okay.
Yeah. I mean, it further puts this moralistic standard on how we engage in sex and polices our bodies in ways that it shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I also found very interesting is by your own gender identification.
If someone identifies as non-binary,
yeah.
Well, they're like, they're not male or female. So then do they, are they now suddenly, does my friend who identifies as genderqueer, then no longer, are they just, they don't have to worry about that policy, they can go get blood right now? Like, it's convoluted, it's unnecessary. It's a knee-jerk reaction that still hasn't been corrected from 1985.
Do you think that there's still any form of legitimacy behind it? Like, do you personally feel there's any?
No.
Right.
No. There are other countries where there is no deferral period at all. And there are some other countries that have, you know, like a 3-month deferral period. I would say 3-month deferral period is still better than a year, mm-hmm. And still not what we should be striving for. I think that there should be no ban. And in effect, a year deferral period is still a ban. Mm-hmm. As much as the FDA would like to say that, oh, well, look, we took away the lifetime ban, we're not discriminating against anyone, like, let's all go have some cake. Like, no, a 1-year ban on having sex for LGBTQ people is unnecessary and still constitutes a ban, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
We need blood, mm-hmm. right? We do need to keep our blood supply high for things like accidents, for things like mass shootings. Right, where we still like live in a country that has mass shootings on the regular, which we could fix, but our elected officials are choosing not to. And so until they decide to grow up and actually do something about it, we're going to need blood.
Right.
And right now there is a large section of the population for, like, thanks to the FDA, who cannot give blood. Mm-hmm. So if you can give blood, you should go do that, because people like me can't.
Yeah.
And until that gets fixed, and until we fix our country, we are still going to need a lot of blood. And mine apparently isn't good enough for the FDA, so you should go help out.
Thanks again to Jacob for speaking to me. And if anyone's interested or wants to learn more about LGBTQ issues and policy in Minnesota, they should look at Outfront Minnesota's website, outfront.org. Or if you're interested in learning more about blood donation, look to the Red Cross. They have every piece of information you could want to know about blood donation. So for Real College Podcast, I've been Murray Swanson.
So much of the healthcare system is based on trust. We trust that a doctor knows what's best for us. We trust that we'll be listened to. That when something is wrong, doctors or nurses or just somebody is going to help us. But that doesn't always happen. Liv Riggins and Ben Hallam have more.
Hans operationer av luftstrupar framodlade genom stamceller har väckt uppmärksamhet världen över.
Surgeons in Sweden have carried out the world's first transplant of a synthetic organ.
An 11-year-old boy has had pioneering treatment to rebuild his...
That's an excerpt from investigative journalist Basi Lindquist's 2016 BBC documentary, Fatal Experiments. The documentary series unraveled celebrity surgeon Paolo Macchiarini's lies about the efficacy of plastic tracheas he developed and implanted in patients with trachea disorders. These implantations led to fatalities, but little was done to stop Macchiarini from effectively experimenting on patients.
A few years away from this all happening, all the organs being built in a lab.
Macchiarini's deception has been called one of the largest medical malpractice scandals to date. Ben Hallam and I got a chance to sit down with Bossy Lindquist and talk about his reporting work after screening of Lindquist's documentary here at the University of Minnesota. So just to start off, what's the general summary of the story you explore in your documentary series?
The series of documentaries about an Italian super surgeon, a celebrity surgeon, Paolo Maccherini, who used to be the leading star of one of the leading stars of the medical establishment, and it was lauded and promoted by the people who issued the Nobel Prize, and who claimed that he had found this miraculous method to transplant organs and to create new organs that had failed. And the only problem was that it was an elaborate lie, and that his patients suffered terrible deaths, and that he cheated about the real outcome in his scientific writing. So there's this whole trove of articles in the scientific papers with fake science that misled the world.
So how did you get the idea to begin pursuing this subject as a documentary, and like how did you begin doing your research?
I was tipped off that there were four senior surgeons at the Karolinska University Hospital in Stockholm who had leveled a formal complaint to the vice chancellor of the Karolinska Institute that they had this colleague who was not only more or less killing his patients, but was lying about it in his scientific papers and producing fake science. That was extraordinary, but then I was also told that the leadership of the hospital and the university were not investigating the accused, but the accusers. They were going for the whistleblowers and pursuing them in different ways, calling the police, threatening them with losing their jobs, their scientific grants, etc. And then I understood that something very, very strange was going on. I mean, four senior surgeons, that's either they're crazy or the leadership of the university and the hospital are corrupt, basically.
When you have a tip like this that's kind of leading to the conclusion that a lot of the people you might need to get in contact with are corrupt or engaged in wrongdoing, how do you go about getting in contact or go about beginning your research in that subject?
Well, I try to be honest. I find that's sort of the only way that works for me in the long run. So I told them that I heard there was this formal complaint, which sounded strange and incredible and outrageous, and that I'm the kind of person who wants to know what is true and what is not, and I'm not interested in sort of black and white simplifications, but I'm interested in the bigger picture and in a more complex reality, and I'd like simply to understand what was happening. And that is all I said, and that led all these people to open up.
Thinking about all these people, particularly Maccherini, you got to spend a lot of time with him during the course of doing this series of documentaries, and just kind of how did you get to spend that time with him, and kind of what was it like being with this man?
Exactly, and what was in it for him? I mean, I think that he and the university who recommended him to talk to me, they thought that I would exonerate him, that I would prove that he was in the right, that he was not killing his patients. And why they thought so, I don't know. They knew I was an investigative reporter, an investigative journalist with a track record of sort of doing that kind of stuff. But I think they sincerely thought that I would show them that what they hoped for was true, that he was a good guy.
Over the course of working with or talking to Maccherini and spending time with him, did you get a feeling for how he was able to pass off this science, how he was able to construct this career kind of out of nothing?
Absolutely. I mean, he is an extremely skilled person, very smart, intelligent, charismatic, beautiful, fun, etc. And he uses tiny lies that he slowly builds into something bigger. So this whole trajectory started long time ago in the 90s when he started at the beginning of his medical career, slowly building the base that made people believe that he would just give them the moon. He would produce Nobel Prizes. He would produce inventions that create lots of money. And if you read this piece in Vanity Fair about his love life, there's a piece in Vanity Fair that you might Google, about his relationship with Benita Alexander, an NBC award-winning producer in New York. You can see how he used that faculty for creating an alternative reality, how he used that in his love life in exactly the same way that he used it in academia and medicine, creating tiny lies that slowly builds into something much bigger and much more dangerous and catastrophic.
Thank you. And so why do you think people were inclined to believe Macchiarini's lies, or how was he able to convince so many people for so long, and why did no one check up on it?
Well, he's very good at sort of sussing out your hopes, your secret hopes, what you wish for in life. He's very good at reading people. And if somebody comes and says that he can give you what you dream for, it's hard to resist. It's something that you prick up your ears and you want to believe.
What do you think were the wishes and dreams that Macchiarini was playing to for these surgeons and doctors and academics, you know, people who you would expect or at least want to be a bit more analytical in their decision-making?
Well, they were hoping for money, they were hoping for grants, they were hoping for prizes, they were hoping for inventing something that would save mankind. I mean, there were all these sort of things that made it easier to do wishful thinking.
After spending time with Macchiarini and investigating this, to what extent was he engaged in his own wishful thinking, or what extent did he believe in his own myth-making?
I really don't understand him, but I think that it's a combination, that he actually did deceive himself at the same time as actually he knew that he was lying, and that's strange. But somehow I think that he did this at the same time, that he believed his lies and he didn't believe them at the same time. And I don't think you can lie in that way unless you partly believe that it's true.
Do you think there's anything that could be put in place or anything that could be done to prevent this kind of lying and this kind of mass deception from happening again?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you cannot prevent the lying from happening, but you can do something about academia and the world of hospitals and medicine. Because I think the worst thing was that when the world, conscientious four Swedish surgeons who discovered what was happening and that he was lying in his sciences, etc., the system, the establishment, should have listened to them and they should have taken note of the accusations and they should have investigated Macchiarini instead of hounding the whistleblowers. And so this is where things have to be reformed. You cannot treat whistleblowers this way. And I think the situation is the same in the US. Whistleblowers, you're shooting the guy who's playing the piano. I mean, you're shooting the whistleblower rather than the people accused. And that's the first thing to do something about. And then hospitals and universities actually lack oversight to a degree which is quite astonishing. It holds true, I think, for most countries that normally when something goes wrong, it's the university or the hospital that investigate themselves instead of, you know, appointing a totally impartial investigator. And that is something that also could be changed.
All right, thank you. I think that's great for us. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Thank you very much for having me here.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
I'm Liv Riggins.
As I said at the beginning, I don't normally think about healthcare or medicine much. But that ignorance, that ability to tune out all things medical, is a privilege. A privilege that people with chronic illnesses don't have. Nathan Fervoy has more.
It's never exactly a fantastic time to be diagnosed with a chronic disease, but my timing turned out to be somewhat fortunate. Still very much a child, but approaching the brink of changes that accompany puberty, diabetes came a knocking during my last months of elementary school. After a few days in the hospital, I stepped back into the world with a box of syringes and a finger pricker. On the brink of the many new stresses that come with adolescence and the start of independence, the summer before middle school was uncomplicated by cell phones or a social life. Instead, it gave me time and space to practice the transfer of responsibility of regulating my blood sugar, formerly held by my pancreas, to my conscious brain. I focused on the new bodily sensations that accompanied my diagnosis. I remember laying on the couch, a restless feeling going up through my legs as my blood sugar rose, and feeling the sharpness of vision and clarity of thought before the blur and shaking of the low. Feeling off, I would choose a finger and prick it, squeezing out a tiny pearl of dark red. I began to associate these bodily sensations with a number, translated from my blood and displayed on the dim screen of my glucose meter.
I would have assumed that when you're high, you were more hyperactive. But you're saying how, like, when you're low, that's when you're all weird.
It's an unnatural transfer of responsibility from one organ, the pancreas, to another, the brain. If given the proper attention, the brain can adequately assume the responsibility of regulating blood sugar with the help of the finger pricker and a syringe full of insulin.
I guess I kind of noticed that you look pale when it's really going down.
I paid increasing attention to my sense of internal level as I proceeded through middle school and into high school. It became clear that my level was a central baseline factor for my proper functioning in any given situation. If it was off, my ability to socialize, my focus, and my emotions would be off as well. The high stakes of constant high school social interaction drove this sentiment into my skull. Walking down the hall and stopping to chat, flirting in the corner of a party. If I was going to present myself as the person I wanted to be, my levels first had to be in control. I became attentive and then compulsive in my constant monitoring, pulling out the meter to prick my finger more than 15 times a day in whatever situation. And between the finger pricks, I was more often than not gauging my bodily sensations for a sense of where my levels were at. Conscious effort is adequate, but far from perfect. The brain becomes preoccupied with the many other tasks it must direct, moving blood glucose responsibilities to the back seat. Levels can easily move out of a healthy range.
Does being super high or super low make you better at sex?
Highs and lows interfere with normal functioning in every aspect of life, from sleep to focus to sex, and can be dangerous if left untreated for long periods.
Super low.
Yeah, really?
Those who wish to live healthy and unhindered must devote precious hours of their day to simply taking care of glucose responsibilities.
Does it help to exercise when you're super high up there?
The introduction of the continuous glucose monitor, or CGM, into my daily life some 5 years after being diagnosed significantly reduced both the time it took to check my blood sugar and the surrounding anxiety. Through the incorporation of a constant blood sugar reading into an iPhone app, my compulsion to check and recheck was made into a quick, socially acceptable compulsion to glance at my phone rather than breaking out the meter and making myself bleed in the middle of a party. The device serves as a constant confirmation to my bodily sense of blood glucose level. It relieves the looming fear in the back of my mind by taking on some of the monitoring responsibility. When the automobile first entered our lives, it came as a loyal servant. Endless possibilities opened up when sitting at its wheel, the road unfurling around us in all directions. It both expanded the reach and granted us further control over our individual destinies. Yet when under our control, the car is plagued by whichever human issues we bring to it. Distraction, drinking, exhaustion, causing crashes and carnage. The problem of travel solved, the progress of technology shifts focus to the next glaring problem, us humans. The self-driving car serves us, taking us where we want, when we want, and it does so flawlessly, much faster and safer than any human driver could. But we do not have control. We trust in the machine, its many engineers and designers, granting it the responsibility of protecting our own bodily well-being. Years pass. We forget how to drive and we don't teach our kids. And then, one morning, we get in, shut the door, and the car bolts without hesitation head on through the garage wall. We cannot stop it, for the brakes were long ago forgotten and removed. Asher is 14, 5 years younger than myself, with an experience of learning to manage diabetes which parallels my own. He too was diagnosed in the fifth grade and stepped out of the hospital with a simple glucose meter and a box of syringes. However, a crucial difference arose soon after, according to his mother, Lisa.
And then, but when he was first diagnosed, he got a Dexcom continuous glucose monitor, a CGM, and he got that.
The adoption of the CGM only weeks after being diagnosed and an insulin pump some months later removed the burden of self-monitoring from Asher's life, instead placing the responsibility on his devices and watchful mother. The system worked for him until one morning before school.
He could not get his blood sugar down, and he woke up in the morning still with very high blood sugar, and he went to swimming practice because exercise will drop your blood sugar, kind of to swim off that whatever was going on. And instead, when he got out of the pool, he was even higher, and his pump read more than 500, because when it's more than 500, it reads high, H-I-G-H. And so he realized he wasn't feeling well, and he went to the school nurse.
At the nurse, they determined Asher's ketone levels were high, the result of prolonged high blood sugar. Later, it was determined that his blood sugar wasn't coming back down because the site of insertion of his pump had failed.
No liquid was coming out onto his skin, and the adhesive looked fine and normal. And so there was no indication that the cannula wasn't in his body. And
that morning, one of the devices Asher was so dependent upon failed for the first time, leaving him without any insulin whatsoever. Luckily, his other device, the CGM, was still functioning and informed him of his dangerous levels. Had it not, and had he been incapable of gauging his own level, the situation would have been far worse.
Purple. It's very dangerous, and you could be very sick, like, and end up in the ICU. You can die from it. So he never had that before. It was our first experience.
Asher's development of treatment practice is as personal and complex as my own. For this reason, differences in our daily practices attributed to his early adoption of the CGM cannot be fully unentangled. However, there is a clear contrast with my own monitoring habits from which an explanation can be drawn. Asher's adoption of the CGM so soon after being diagnosed likely resulted in him skipping the years I spent learning the intricacies of my internal blood sugar gauge. The days of syncing up my sluggishness to a rising level, my inability to sleep to a falling one. He did not feel the need to interpret his bodily sensations because the CGM did this for him. Instead of taking on the responsibility, he could remain a carefree kid for a bit longer. In diabetes treatment, like all other sectors, digital technology is being increasingly embraced for its problem-solving ability. Various medical companies now await FDA approval on a model of a medical device called an artificial pancreas, a name which summons the image of a lab-cultivated organ to replace the malfunctioning natural one. In fact, the device is really the next obvious step. It combines the insulin pump and CGM into a single, self-correcting system, further removing any nagging responsibility from the diabetic. As we talked, Asher's mother, Lisa, questioned me about my supplemental use of the CGM, my underlying reliance on my own internal conscious gauge.
I wish he had that experience, actually. But he was so much younger.
Of course, as his mother, she'd like to see Asher independent and able to take care of his health in any situation. I'm, of course, happy to have avoided revisiting the emergency room since my diagnosis. Yet there is a part of me that envies Asher's freedom from bodily anxiety. I wonder where my mind might have wandered, down which lanes my thoughts might have led me had I not been continuously slapped back to the physical reality of my body for all those years.
Well, that's all from Real College Podcast. Thanks to everyone who helped out on this episode, Maury Swanson, Ben Hallam, Liv Briggins, and Nathan Furboy. Real College Podcast is produced by Nathan Furboy, Liv Briggins, Ben Hallam, and Lizzie Ritchie. Alex Schumacher is the host and managing editor. All episodes can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.